Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 148, recorded April 21st, 2014. Vint Cerf, part 2. Triangulation is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Amazon gift card when you get a loan. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we talk to some of the most interesting people in the tech business. And boy, I don't think you can get more interesting than Vint Cerf. This is part two of our conversation. A couple of weeks ago, we did a hangout with Mr. Cerf under the aegis of Google's Take Action page and talked a little bit about the internet, how to keep it free and open. And I'm so glad that we could get a little more time to talk together, Mr. Cerf. Thank you for being here. Are you back in your offices in... No, it looks like you're home today.
I'm actually at home today. I could have set this up in the library to make it look like a better background.
But, that's fine.
I don't know if I could raise this
you're
thing
in
up.
The kitchen. I think that's
nice
more appropriate.
Shot of the kitchen. That's right. There we are.
It's a nice-looking kitchen. You like to cook?
I do when I get the opportunity, which is not often enough.
You mentioned, we talked many years ago, and I think it was right after your wife got a cochlear implant, and you were really excited about that.
I still am, and that was, 1996. So that's 18 years ago?
And
wow.
It's still working.
It's working beautifully. She had a second one in 2006, so now she has both ears running electronically. It's very impressive.
It's an amazing technology. It really is. Imagine how we felt about it in 1996.
No, well, at that point, it was still not entirely standard technology.
Right.
So by this time, it's not only is it more common, but you discover that even infants as young as 6 months could be implanted because the electronics have gotten small enough to allow that. Of course, the question is, how do you determine whether they are, in fact, profoundly deaf and therefore... in need of such an implant, that I don't know all the details of how that's detected. But of course, to learn normal speech, the earlier you could be implanted, the better, because then your brain begins to adapt around the sounds that it's hearing, which it otherwise would not do. And as you know, we've learned a great deal about how the brain develops, and it turns out that we start out with an over a supply of interconnectivity in the brain. And the oral and other, sense feedback changes what the connectivity is. Things that don't get used wither away. And so it's more like an etching process than it is a growing process, which is, I think, not what many people imagine. So this is quite a powerful lesson that the early years have a very, very direct impact on the way your brain is wired.
It's funny that you should mention it, because we were talking about this last week with Jeff Hawkins, who's...
Yes. Jeff has a wonderful book on intelligence.
Exactly.
And the other one, How to Create a Mind. Another guy to talk to, if you can get him, is Ray Kurzweil.
We've talked to him several times, and I would love to get him back on. He and Ray are a little bit at odds, because Ray, of course, says, I want to live long enough to live forever. At some point, they're going to pour my mind into a computer or a machine, just like this movie that just came out, Transcendence. And Jeff says... A, you don't want it, and B, it probably is never going to happen. But more importantly, you don't want it if it could happen. But that's what's really interesting about cochlear implants. So here it is, a computer that is, as I understand it, essentially replacing the cochlea to send directly into the brain
into
the sound.
The auditory nerve. Yeah. If you have a moment, I can say roughly the way this
That'd
works.
That'd be great, yeah.
The microphone takes in the sound. And it goes into the speech processor, which is getting smaller and smaller. They make behind-the-ear versions, although my wife likes the one that she put to her belt because the controls are larger, so she can actually change the level of sensitivity and the volume and so on. But this speech processor takes in the sound, analyzes it with a Fourier transform in order to figure out which frequencies are present and at what amplitudes. And then it figures out which of the, in her case, 16 electrodes that are embedded inside the cochlea touching the auditory nerve. Which of those 16 should be stimulated in order to emulate the neural signal that the brain interprets as sound? And what is truly astonishing is first that we even know how to do that. But the second and most dramatic thing is, in my case or in my wife's case, is that within about 20 minutes of fitting the speech processor and turning it on and getting the map organized with its initial setup, she was able to pick up the phone and talk to me on the phone. This is after we've been married for 30 years and never been able to use the phone. So
wow.
It was just a stunning experience. And, of course, it got better and better over time, except that I could never get her off the phone. She was a 50-year-old teenager. It was incredible.
All the things she'd been missing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, including telemarketing. I mean, I used to work for MCI at that point, right? So we'd get calls from telemarketers for AT&T, and she would say, oh, hello, where are you? Oh, you're in India. Well, what part of India are you
great.
In? You know, she would go on for half an hour. And the poor person, you know, at the other end, say, at the end, you know, say, well, are you going to switch? She said, no, my husband works for MCI. I think but thanks for calling.
But we've had a wonderful talk.
Exactly.
At this point, I think it's first of all, it's very obvious that the internet and I didn't even introduce you as the father of the internet. I presume that anybody who watches our stuff knows exactly who Vint Cerf is. And of course, now you work at Google as chief internet evangelist. But I think at this point, it's clear the internet is one of the most significant inventions of humankind. And I always think when I interview people of your stature, people who are so important historically on something like that, that 100, 200 years from now, this conversation will be part of the historic record. That horse, I'm channeling a historian from 200 years in the future now to ask you some questions about this historic invention. So if you'll pardon that, I'll do my best.
No, actually, this is quite interesting and is relevant to a big issue that I have. It's called the bit rot problem and the preservation of digital information.
Yes.
And we may come to that if there's time.
I wouldn't mind starting there because clearly historians of the future are very, very worried about that. But somebody, I think, accurately said, in a way, history began just a few decades ago when we were able to record on audio and then later video. People, we don't know what Abraham Lincoln sounded like or looked or moved like, but we do know now. Do you fear that this record, though, will be lost?
Yes, I do. And let me give you the small problem, which is also a very hard problem, and then the big problem. The small problem is merely the ability not only to preserve bits, which I think we can do. We may have to move them from one digital medium to another. Because as you know, it might be hard to find an 8-inch long floppy disk reader or a 3.5-inch floppy disk reader. And today, you may even have trouble finding a CD reader. I know that my Macintosh MacBook Pro does not have CD reader in it, which I was not happy about. But here we are. So the medium may change, but we can copy bits from one medium to another if we're aware of the changes in the available storage technology. But the other important problem is, how do I interpret the bits? Do I need the software that created them to help me interpret them? If it's a spreadsheet, for example, or if it's a video of one kind or another, will I have documented the formats adequately? How will I remember that? You know, if it's a complex program, like a word processing program or something like that, then you may have difficulty correctly interpreting the complex format without actually having the software that ran to produce it, and then you need the operating system environment that helped run that program, plus the I/O and all this other stuff. So I think it's going to be a challenge to create a regime in which we can preserve the necessary software and ability to interpret bits over periods of centuries to millennia. But that's the small problem. It's still a very hard one. The big problem, in some respects, is whether the internet will still be around or something like it 100 or 200 years from now. There are many challenges even today as to its longevity. It's been around since 1983 in operation. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of publishing the first paper on the internet in May, literally, of 1974. Wow. So it's literally 40 years ago that Bob Klein and I...
The blink of an eye, really.
Well, it, yeah, except I used to have more hair. this paper was published in IEEE Transactions on Communications literally 40 years ago.
Wow.
And tomorrow I'm heading to, or tonight actually, I'm heading to São Paulo, Brazil for the Net Mundial meeting, which is one of many meetings on the whole question of internet governance. And one of the issues in this larger picture is whether we will find adequate models for sustaining the internet going forward, or its successors going forward into the centuries ahead. And I hope so, because it would be nice to imagine that you, as this historian from the year 2014, would be able to get access to this recording and others that are relevant to this period of time.
I think, of course, obviously, the what's lasted up to now is paper or papyrus or some sort of written, carved in stone, written medium. And that's done quite well over thousands
of years. Or baked clay.
Baked clay, right.
What is it, the cuneiform tablets that you get
exactly.
from
yeah.
Assyria or Babylonia.
Yeah. So that's done quite well. But and I guess I had hopes that once we got things to bits, we could at least duplicate them infinitely and make many, you know, make perfect copies. But you're right that there's the issue of what you do. But I always feel like audio, especially uncompressed audio, I think that's going to be, we'll be able to play that back, I hope.
It would be nice to have both, of course, video and audio.
Yeah.
But again, we're back to interpretation.
Right.
You have to understand what the bits mean. A small example of this is, suppose you've made measurements, I don't know, temperature, for example, and you have this recording of numbers, like, you know, 73, 102, 27. The problem is, unless you also remember what the calibration was of the instruments that took the measurement and what the scale was that those numbers represent, what the hell do they mean? Are they Kelvin? You know, are they centigrade? Are they Fahrenheit? Are they something else? And if you don't know that, then you have the numbers perfectly preserved. You have no idea what they mean.
It was the problem, wasn't it, the Carl Sagan face with Voyager putting that record on Voyager and sending it out.
Yes.
How can we do something that maybe a completely alien civilization might understand?
So I love that question, because it does challenge you into thinking, how do I represent things in such a way that you could somehow figure it out?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that they made heavy use of primes, for example, of mathematics in
yes.
order to try to convey certain concepts. I haven't looked carefully at that record. I know that they did some imagery was done in such a way that the length and width were prime numbers. But there's this question of what is the sensory capacity of the alien that might encounter this record. Even if they can get the bits off, will they even recognize what the bits represent if they don't have sensory apparatus which is comparable? This gets us to the most fundamental point about communication, which is that the parties who try to communicate must share something in order to successfully communicate, with the common language or something else. And in the absence of that sharing, communication is, for all practical purposes, impossible.
And we've come right back around to the internet, because that is the fundamental problem you solved, isn't it, with TCP/IP?
Well, it certainly is one of the most widely implemented protocols on the planet. The other one, which is extremely common, as you know, is the Ethernet format.
Right.
The protocols have varied quite a bit since its origins. In the same year, by the way, 1973 was when Bob Metcalf built the first Ethernets, and that was the year that Bob Kahn and I actually started writing our paper, which was published the following
year. Right. And, you know, it's hard to imagine Ethernet surviving a century or two. Maybe not so hard to imagine packet data and some form of TCP/IP surviving.
Well, the protocol may change, depending on conditions and circumstances. Packet switching, I think, is a very powerful organizing notion,
yeah.
and I'm sure that will be around. To give you an example, when my colleagues and I at the Jet Propulsion Lab started looking at interplanetary communication, we quickly recognized that while the packet switching idea was applicable, the TCP/IP protocols themselves were brittle when it came to disruption and variable delay, significant and variable delay. So we ended up designing a new set of protocols that were more resilient in the face of those conditions. We called it the bundle protocol, just to make it distinct from internet packet protocols.
Solves a different problem, but it's the same packet.
Same notions.
Same notion. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't want. I'm not going to ask you prediction questions. They're silly. Journalists, we love these. You know, what's it going to be like 200 years from now? So I won't ask you that. But do you agree with the premise that the internet is one of the most significant human inventions? I mean, right up there with fire and the wheel.
Wow. Well, many people like to compare it to Gutenberg's movable type press because it made it possible to share information much more readily and far more cheaply than with having scribes copy things onto vellum manuscripts. The invention, it's not so much the details of the design. I think that any number of protocols might have worked, including the OSI protocols that TCP competed with. But the idea of having something in common, something that was standard, and that everybody would implement, that's the most powerful notion. And Bob and I and our colleagues were lucky that we found a path towards adoption, widespread adoption of those particular protocols. Once adopted, though, you're quite right, it created an extraordinary infrastructure. And then to give credit to Tim Berners-Lee and Mark Andreessen and Eric Bina, who developed the World Wide Web, in the case of Tim Berners-Lee, and then the Mosaic browser, which brought the internet to life as a as an application. These are all examples of inventions which happen when it is possible for them to happen.
Right.
The internet creates the infrastructure that would support these ideas. And that, I think, is an important lesson, that many things get invented only when it's possible to invent them. And the people who were lucky to have been around at a time when it was possible are the ones who get credit. But it's partly an accident of history.
If I have seen farther than others, it is because I have stood on the shoulder of giants, as Newton said. So, and I think that's absolutely true. However, we're very lucky to live at this juncture in history where something magical happened. It was, you know, I think of the golden spike, the last spike connecting the east and west coast of the North American continent, as a moment in time when something clicked and everything changed.
This was 1869, if I remember right, and it was in Utah. And I think Senator Stanford may have had something to do with that.
I think you're right.
He even have been present at the time.
Yeah,
but you're quite right. I mean, that's a dramatic moment for the country's development. And I think internet, as it has evolved, and to quite honestly, the other element here, which we shouldn't neglect, is mobile technology.
Yes.
Which has turned out to be stunningly effective. It's reduced the cost for many to make use of it. And the smartphones are able to give you access to internet in its capacity pretty much anywhere you happen to be if you're in range of the base station. So those two technologies have come together in a way which I think is remarkable. Ironically, the mobile phone was designed in 1973 by Marty Cooper. And so there must have been something interesting about 1973.
It was a magical time. You know, we had Marty Cooper on about 4 weeks ago talking about that. Yeah.
Did he tell you that the big brick, the Motorola brick, weighed, I don't know, 2.5 pounds or something. And he said he had it had a battery life of 20 minutes.
Yep.
That was okay because he couldn't hold it up longer than that anyway.
I didn't mention that, but it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's and I guess this is why I feel very privileged, never having made a big invention like that, but to have been able to be at ringside seats for a really transformative time in humankind. And I think the transformation is about communication and about uniting us across this big globe. And I can only imagine what a change this is bringing.
So I think that I like your metaphor, the communication side, let's think for a moment in looking back in history. Think about Marco Polo, which, if I remember right, was 13th century.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Going to China, and it is that and seagoing trade which also facilitated communication. You got artifacts from places and learned things as a result of seeing and using those artifacts, or food, or you know, spices, and so on. And so your point is illustrated throughout history, often as a consequence of trade routes and intrepid people who risked everything to go from point A to point B and then back again to point A. It's quite astonishing, but the benefits were impressive.
Is there a golden spike moment in the history of the internet?
Yeah, boy, that's a really interesting question. I know that I have one, a personal golden spike sense for me. It was November 22nd, 1977. This was the first time that we were able to get all three of the experimental packet switch networks that the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency funded to work together using TCP/IP. One was a mobile packet radio network operating in the San Francisco Bay Area. Second network was the ARPANET, which had been initiated in 1968 and turned on in late 1969. And the third network was the Atlantic Packet Satellite Network, which operated between the east coast of the U.S. and the western part of Europe over Intelsat 4A. And so all three of these networks were outfitted with TCP/IP capability, or at least gateways that could link them together using TCP/IP. And we demonstrated all three networks operating together on that day. And I remember feeling chills going up and down my spine, thinking, I think, you know, it's like the rain in Spain stays mainly in the plane. I think she's got it.
I think we've got it.
I think she's got it.
Wow. And what's interesting is it was radio. It wasn't, we always think of computer networks being joined, but two of these were radio networks being joined to a computer network.
And one of them was mobile.
And one of them was mobile.
Everything else.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, but that was the point, I gather, of the exercise, was to get heterogeneous devices talking to one another.
Yes, in the case of the ARPANET, which was the initial foray into wide area packet switching, the objective was to get diverse computers and their operating systems to interwork successfully. And to do that, Steve Crocker, a colleague at UCLA, led that effort and developed something called NCP, which stood for something like Network Control Program. John Postel and Steve Crocker and I and Bob Braden and others were working in Glenn Kleinrock's laboratory at UCLA during that development period. So we showed that computers of different brands could be made to interwork. And Bob and I worked on the multiple network case and showed that using a different set of protocols with some different properties that were less dependent on network performance, that it was possible to make all of these computers and the networks into work in a basically transparent way.
How cool is that? Way back in, I'm looking at it now, 1998, Katie Hafner wrote A History of the Internet, Where Wizards Stay Up Late. Accurate, you feel like, a good representation of what happened?
Well, a lot of, you will recall that the subtitle is Origins of the Internet.
Right.
And that was wisely chosen because the book covers mostly ARPANET development and the early stages of Internet. There are other books like Leaving the Web that Tim Berners-Lee wrote, covers a period in the late 1980s and for all practical purposes, the early 1990s as the World Wide Web emerges, Netscape Communication comes along. There's this gap from 1973 to 1993, which is not well covered by most written histories. And it is the story of Internet's evolution, the battles with X25 and OSI, the fights with governments that wanted to go down one path, but the users of the world went down another, the use of TCP/IP and Unix, which rapidly proliferated thanks to Sun Microsystems and Ethernet technology. The whole story there, which hasn't been written and is something on my list of things to do if I ever retire.
That book's never going to get written, I have a feeling. Maybe, but not by you anyway. Maybe
it really should be. It really should be written because it's such an interesting period in history. So as your 200-year-old historian idea makes me think that somebody needs to do that.
Sooner than later.
that point. Yes, because all of our memory cells are starting to leak.
Yeah. You say an interesting thing, and I hadn't really thought about it. Would it have been a different world if OSI, if the competition between OSI and TCP had ended with the success of OSI?
Well, it would have been different in detail. The OSI protocols had several complex aspects to them. There were five different versions of the transport protocol, mm-hmm. version 0 through 4. And so that raises all kinds of questions about, well, what if you were trying to communicate with somebody else and the somebody else didn't do the one that you were implementing? So you have a real problem. X25 had similar kinds of negotiation problems. And then there was the underlying assumptions for the OSI protocols. One group wanted to use virtual circuits, X25 being an example of that, and others wanted to use a connectionless mode of operation. So there would have been, I think it would have been harder to make the OSI protocols proliferate widely in a uniform way. The one thing that the Internet Engineering Task Force tended to focus on, as well as the Internet Architecture Board, is that if you're going to do anything in a protocol space, you should do it one way, not more than one way, mm-hmm. in order to avoid the problem of not implementing the same thing on each end. And we had the benefit of that, and I think that probably helped.
TCP/IP was a little simpler, a little easier to implement, and obviously has been effective.
If you didn't have to implement everything else along with it, yes, that's right.
What would you have done differently, knowing now what you know?
Well, now looking back, I wish that I had had better access to public key crypto. It was published. We know that it was invented, but not published in 1974 by GCHQ in the UK. But they kept it secret. And then Wick Diffie and Marty Hellman published their seminal paper in 1977 describing the possibilities of public key cryptography, but they didn't have an algorithm for it. Somewhat after that, probably in 1978, although you probably have to do some Googling to make sure, the RSA algorithm pops up. And I think Diffie-Hellman also had the Diffie-Hellman protocol as well. But by the time 1978 arrives, we're now in the final stages of standardizing the Internet that you're using now. So for all practical purposes, you're running the 1978 plus or minus version of the Internet. The standards were revised somewhat around 1981. And then widely implemented to launch the Internet on January 1st, 1983. But we didn't have access to technology that was widely available. And to make matters more complicated, there had been a design of the of protocols for packet cryptography with the help of the National Security Agency. It used a DES implementation for cryptography, and it used conventional key distribution, which means that you were using symmetric keys rather than public key pairs. So we had a design, but it was not scalable in my view, and could not become scalable until the public key crypto became available. And even now, I think we're still, all of us, struggling to get crypto into the right place effectively and easily used so that we can secure things end-to-end at various layers in the Internet architecture.
And we're seeing how difficult that is with the Heartbleed flaw.
That's actually a real application bug as opposed to a crypto problem.
Right.
But it's nonetheless important because the SSL, open SSL software clearly allowed someone, if they had figured out this particular weakness, could have exploited it for quite a while. So we have a lot of work to do. I think there's ample impetus now, more so than ever, to implement increasingly easy-to-use cryptographic methods for strong authentication and for confidentiality and integrity. And I'm hoping that the next several years we'll see a substantial growth in the use of those technologies to protect all of us.
So, we can layer it on now. We can use PGP in our email and everything. But do you think it should be kind of part of how the Internet works?
Well, it is in some respects. I mean, if you recognize that the transport layer of security and IPsec and so on are part of right. the various layers of the internet that those are designed in. Whether they're widely implemented is a different question, but they're designed in. PGP is sort of an applique that sits on top of email, and I think it would be an improvement to make it all part of the standard email package, make it very easy for you to discover, or the software to discover what your recipient's public key is, so that you can send an encrypted copy of a symmetric key so that the other party, receiving party, can decrypt the message. All those things, the key distribution aspects and everything, should be made just as easy as possible. No harder, for right. example, than using a contact list to click on people's names and have all the right email addresses pop up on the headers. That we really need to do is integrate it in and make it standard so that everyone can expect to be able to encrypt traffic at need on an end-to-end basis.
We're talking to Vint Cerf. Many call him the father of the internet, chief internet evangelist for Google, and we have much more to talk about, including what's ahead of the internet and more internet history, because I love that stuff. But I do want to mention a company that we've had a little bit to do with, Prosper.com, a company that is using the internet to transform how people lend and borrow money. Prosper is really quite a remarkable invention. It's peer-to-peer lending. So the idea is Prosper is a site that brings people together, people who have money to lend with people who have money that they need to borrow. 95,000 people have borrowed on Prosper.com, over $1 billion to date. Just amazing. 2 million total members, lenders and borrowers. Imagine what you would do if you could just say, you know what, I need to go online and get, $35,000. And you do, and 72 hours later, you got it. What would you do with that? Would you pay off your high-rate credit cards, or maybe do a little home improvement, start a business? I like that one. Start a business. The application, you see it right there, is easy to fill out. You provide a few details. You'll get your rate online almost instantly, and it will not affect your credit score. Prosper offers low fixed rates, unsecured personal loans. There's no collateral required. There are multi-year terms available. Prosper is Silicon Valley's answer to personal loans. You'll never set foot in a bank again. Never have to put on a suit. Never have to dress up to talk to the banker. Prosper, it doesn't have outrageous fees. There's no rising interest rates, and it's just easy. I want you to visit prosper.com/twit. And as a little thank you, you can check your rate right now. If you take out a loan, we'll get you a $50 Amazon gift card when you get that loan. Prosper.com/twit. It's a special site just for our viewers. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days and an Amazon gift card worth $50 when you get a loan. I have to mention Prosper is not affiliated with Amazon. For gift card details, visit prosper.com/twit. A great idea and a perfect example of how the internet just kind of makes things much more, simple, just lubricates the transaction. Really is, it is, we live in amazing times. Prosper.com/twit. Vint Cerf is our guest. We're talking about this little thing he invented called the internet. You've heard of it? What's your opinion? I asked you a little bit about this last time we talked, but I want to go a little deeper. What's your opinion of the damage that the Edward Snowden's NSA revelations have had to the internet? It seems to have hurt the United States' stature. For sure.
Well, let's actually, before we go there, I just wanted to mention, you said, what would I do differently?
And we never really got to that.
I would have used 128 bits of address space, so we didn't have to go through this.
We'll get to IPv6 too, don't worry.
Boy, but it would have been hard to justify needing 3.4 times 10 to the 38 addresses to do an experiment.
They would have said, Vint, you're a little optimistic about how this is going to work out.
Exactly. I mean, there were only 400 machines on the internet in 1983. I mean, so what's with this, 10 to the 38th address?
Come on, what do you think? This thing's going to become big?
Yeah. it would have been personally embarrassing to have to make that case, because you would think you really had a swollen head.
You got to think big, though, man. You got to think big when you're talking the internet, man.
Right. So to come back to this other thing, the Snowden revelations have been striking in several ways. It certainly has triggered a much-needed conversation not only here in the United States, but elsewhere, about the role of surveillance in the intelligence community and the rights of users in this digital environment. I think that a lot of harm has been caused as well. And I think opinions vary on that point. I wish there had been a better way for Mr. Snowden to trigger this dialogue. I'd like to think that it would have worked better if he just said, you know what, there's a problem and we should talk about it. But maybe that wouldn't have worked. So I think the jury's still out. The U.S. Reputation and its stature with regard to human rights protections probably suffered from this, because it's pretty clear that the surveillance was substantial. It is fair to say, however, that we are not the only country in the world with similar aspirations. If you read the Russian laws called SORM, SORM-1 and SORM-2, and I'm sorry, I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but they are laws that give the replacement for the KGB the authority to do a substantial degree of surveillance in Russia. And you can be sure that there are other authoritarian governments where similar kinds of rules exist, China being an example. And in the UK, quite apart from GCHQ, I think it's well known that television surveillance is common and widespread. And I think the population there understands and appreciates why that may have been important when the 2007 two bomber struck, bombers, plural, struck. They were identified, if I am remembering correctly, rather quickly from the videos that had been recorded and analyzed. So we have this tremendous tension between protecting the safety of citizens from either domestic or external attack, while at the same time trying to figure out how to protect their rights. And there's a tussle there that is not fully resolved.
This is the eighth layer, the social impact of a network technology. Do you? I imagine that it while at the same you see the benefits and the consequences of what you've created. It's not for you to concern yourself particularly about that, or is it?
Well, it is, and I think, Leo, that that's a very reasonable question for you to ask or issue to raise. I think technologists need to be much more aware of the side effects of their technology. They can say that technology is neutral and that it can be used and abused, and this is true of the Internet. But at the same time, I think that technologists need to at least think about that and ask themselves, well, what abuses could occur? Are there technical things I can do to minimize the possibility of abuse? If I cannot solve all the problems using technical means, do I need legal frameworks in which to minimize or at least respond to abusive practices on the net? And you can understand that the abuses on the Internet are quite broad. They show up offline as well. I mean, there's stalking, there's bullying, there's fraud, there's identity theft. There's all these, you know. Now, one thing that's unique to the Internet is viruses and worms and Trojan horses, although you remember that they used to propagate on floppy disks.
That's right.
Before people were using Internet widely, or they're attached to emails and things like that. So these abuses are present. And the worst is that they occur on a transnational basis. And so in order to deal with them, you need to have a certain amount of collaboration, both between government and private sector, but also between governments and law enforcement agencies, to say nothing of getting the general population to be more knowledgeable about, we call it safe networking, with use of public key cryptography and strong authentication, two-factor authentication, and things of that sort, and being thoughtful about not clicking on emails that have, you know, a .php attachment or a .exe attachment. People need to be educated the same way kids have to be told, look both ways before you cross the street. This just should become second nature, and we have a long way to go to get people comfortably educated about that.
You know, I think of J. Robert Oppenheimer, another father, a father of the atom bomb. And I think you in the milieu of World War II, and you create this, you're trying to save humanity, you feel, and at the same time, what did he say? I become death, the destroyer of worlds. He recognized the real horrors that he might have released at the same time.
Yeah. You know, the first issue, of course, was that the fear was that the Germans might actually get to an atomic bomb first.
Right.
And that was what led to the letter from Einstein to President Roosevelt and the beginning of the Manhattan Project. When that first bomb was tested in, I want to say July of 1945.
Trinity, yeah.
Trinity. One of the comments, which he paraphrased from Oppenheimer, was a quote from the Bhagavad Gita. I am Shiva, or I have become Shiva, destroyer of worlds, as the bomb went off. And they were really worried. They were afraid that they might ignite the atmosphere. And, you know, when you don't quite know enough and you do it anyway, that's pretty scary.
I guess your invention didn't have the potential to ignite the atmosphere. But you have lit a few fires. I mean, it really has changed almost every aspect of activity here in the developed world anyway. I just think of education. I think of work. I think of how we entertain ourselves, how we communicate. All changed dramatically.
So in some ways, let me argue that it hasn't changed that much. I mean, we use this as a medium for distributing video. We use it as a medium for distributing audio. We use it for text communications. And those media have been around for a while, so we're repurposing the internet to deliver those. They're familiar objects. What is not so familiar is the interactive nature, and also the fact that we've lowered the barrier to almost anyone producing this kind of content and sharing it.
Exactly.
So we see, you know, hundreds of hours, I don't know how many, of video being uploaded to YouTube per minute, and God knows how many are actually watched. Sometimes it's like blogs. You know, I think the average number of people reading a blog is 1.4, which is the author and his dog.
The last stat I saw was 100 hours of video every minute and 6 billion hours of video every month viewed.
Oh, moly. That's amazing.
View.
We use these technologies to entertain ourselves. But what I think is dramatically different, the economics are different, for one thing, and that's very disruptive. And the second thing is that they are potentially very interactive, unlike their incarnation in other forms. And it's the interaction and the economics that are having such a huge impact on business and business models.
I think, though, I've always felt that, of course, just as with Gutenberg and movable type, the first things you do with an invention like this is things you're familiar with. You print Bibles, or you make magazines or television shows on the internet. And that the generation growing up now, the internet native generation, may find different uses, unfamiliar uses for this invention. That's one of the beauties of what you've done, is it is very free form. It's really just letting people communicate and distribute their ideas and thoughts and interact, and who knows what'll come of it.
Exactly. And I think this recognition that creating a platform and an environment where ideas can be explored, new inventions can be tried out without having to get permission from everybody, is really an important feature. So the openness of the network and its protocols and its design has been a key factor in developing this cornucopia of applications. I get very excited, especially by the mobiles and all the apps that show up there, for the same reason. That's a platform which takes a lot of the detail out of the way of people's implementing the application. So all the, you know, all the packet switching and the bit formatting and all that other stuff is taken care of for you. As long as you just run through this interface, you're in good shape. So I think Google is an example of a company that recognizes that it doesn't have a corner on creativity, and so it creates platforms like Google Earth that intentionally stimulate people's ability to try out new ways of using those technologies.
I do love the word platform, because that really, whether it's an operating system, a hardware device like the PC or the internet, that really is what's happened here, is we've just make a place for you to stand, and what you do with it is up to you now.
Yes, and that's it's like sort of like a table that doesn't know what you put on it.
Right.
It's there. It supports, you know, the dishes and the glasses and the silverware and so on.
There's
and of course, the silverware and
that.
The glasses and the dishes have no idea what they're sitting on. It could be a rock.
Right.
It could be a table.
Right.
It could be, you know, any
They don't need
surface.
To. It's not relevant.
And they don't need to. That's exactly right. So this information hiding aspect of internet is commonly found in other kind of metaphors as well. And it's that separation that's so important and makes easier the use of these technologies for new applications.
And I love the phrase, without their permission. That's, of course, Alexis Ohanian's book, the founder of Reddit. And that is the other great part of this, is that there are no gatekeepers anymore. There are engineering gatekeepers, and you've been a part of that, the IETF. You mentioned ICANN, your former founder and former chairman. Are they doing a good job, do you think, these bodies? Are they balancing the need to regulate with the need to let freedom reign?
Well, I think so. One thing that is fair to say is that a lot of this is new territory. We have a disruptive technology, the domain name system, for example, which collides with trademark, because trademarks are not unique, but domain names have to be, and so we have suddenly have to figure out, well, how do we cope with the collision?
It's a namespace mismatch.
Right. That's one example. Look at the number of institutions that have been invented over the period of the last 30 years in order to help facilitate the growth and use of the internet.
Yeah.
Look at the Internet Engineering Task Force, the Internet Architecture Board, the Internet Research Task Force, the Internet Society, the Regional Internet Registry, ICANN, the domain name server, the root server operators. How about the Internet Exchange Point operators? What about the network operators groups like Danog and the other? I mean, this list goes on on, and it doesn't even include all the different entities that own a piece of the internet and operate it, including you and me, about our home networks. So, I mean, this is vast proliferation of organizations and institutions, and it works, partly because they're all bound together by a common desire to make it work and have it be, you know, one network, not multiple nets. And second, it works because there's standards that let people successfully interoperate without having had an agreement ahead of time. That's what's so wonderful about standards, is that they are a replacement for 7 bazillion bilateral agreements.
It is really, I look at it with awe. It really is remarkable. And it works, and it's so beautiful, so elegant.
Well, we hope it'll stay that way, Leo.
Yeah.
As you know, that there are many discussions going on now, not least of which was triggered by the NTIA announcement that it wanted to finally end its formal contract with ICANN to run the IANA functions, which deal with the Internet address space and ASN numbers and the parameters of the internet protocols and, of course, the domain name system itself. And that stirred up quite a bit of discussion, which will go on now for certainly the rest of this year and into 2015. The next event in the next couple of days is in São Paulo, Brazil, the so-called Net Mundial. But then after that, there's high-level panel meetings coming in Dubai, and then there will be the Internet Governance Forum in Istanbul, and then there will be the ITU's Plenipot in Busan in South Korea. Then there will be other meetings coming in 2015. There's a lot of debate and discussion going on, and my big worry, frankly, is that we fail to figure out how to assure that the Internet continues to operate in this open way.
Yeah.
That it preserves people's rights, it reduces the barriers to access, and combats the violation of human rights. All those things have to be somehow accounted for while we protect the institutions that must work for the internet to function successfully. So it's a complicated environment to deal with, and that's my biggest worry, is that we somehow mess that up. So I hope we don't.
Well, how did you end up at Google, and is that a good place for you to be right now?
Oh, it's a marvelous place. What's not to like about stock that's over $500 a share?
That's a good thing.
After the split,
yeah.
Right, exactly. I was you will recall that MCI was acquired in 1998 by Bernie Evers WorldCom company.
Oh yeah, that.
And
I forgot about that.
Went bankrupt in 2002. Yeah. And I went through that. The big lesson I learned there is that your stock goes to zero.
Yes.
It has no value anymore.
Yes.
That was kind of a rude shock for an engineer who didn't understand that. By good fortune, I stayed there and helped them do my bit and put it back together. Eventually, it was sold to Verizon. And around that point, I decided that I really wanted to explore the applications of the Internet more than just its infrastructure. Good fortune again, Eric Schmidt was a dear friend who had been CTO of Sun Microsystems and then went on to be CEO of Novell, and had been hired by Larry and Sergey around 2000 to be the CEO of Google. So I sent him an email, and they said, Eric, you need some help? And he sent a note back saying, yes.
Awesome.
So that was my job interview. And
The easiest Google job interview in history, I might add. They didn't ask you about manhole covers or anything.
I did have a chance to meet the senior management, too, in a very informal way before I came on board. The thing I like about it is that there's a lot of freedom there. The two founders really care about looking at even crazy ideas, which is what Google X is about. But they built a business model and a management structure that allows them this freedom and flexibility. It's very impressive. And I love being surrounded by all these young people because they force you to rethink what you think you know. So a classic example, somebody will come up and say, I think we should do X for some value of X. And I'll think, oh, we tried that 25 years ago and it didn't work. And then I realize that maybe there's a reason why it didn't work then, and
right.
Maybe the reason is no longer valid, and maybe we should rethink this question. And so I've been forced to rethink lots of ideas over the course of the last 8.5 years that I've been at Google. And believe me, that keeps your brain ticking, because having to rethink your long-held ideas is a healthy thing. It's just like science, right? You know, you have these theories, and you make measurements, and they screw up the theories. Well, you don't mess the measurements up to match the theory, at least not if you're a good scientist. Instead, you redo the theory to match the evidence, and then, of course, you try to test your new theory to see if you can validate that. So Google is a lot like that, and I like that a lot.
It's wonderful to be in a place where, despite your stature, you can still be challenged, you can still grow, you can still find new things. And you're right, I can't imagine a better place, a better laboratory to do that.
Well, believe me, Google, stature doesn't count at Google. You know, I'm just an old fart. And,
the kids don't know.
And I have to earn. I have to earn my keep.
That's
so
awesome.
it's good. It's healthy.
Absolutely.
You know, I've noticed that a lot of academics last longer than many others because they are challenged regularly by a new crop of students every year, and I think there's a lot to that.
Do they use you that way? Do they say, okay, I want you to go talk to Vint? Do you have any teaching role or any mentoring role there?
I think that would be an overstatement. What happens is that a lot of people will come track me down from outside and say, I have an idea. Are you interested? And I have to figure out who at Google would be the right person to pursue that further and decide it isn't the right thing for us. So I spend a lot of time on that. I do spend a lot of time on policy, as you might imagine.
Yes.
And that's an increasingly important topic for us and others who are in the Internet space for all the reasons that you were just alluding to earlier about the uses and abuses of the network and protection of people's rights. I spend a lot of time on that. I'm formally in the research group, and so I have the very good fortune to sort of be able to stick my nose into pretty much anything. And that, too, is very exciting because you get exposed to some ideas that you might not otherwise see. So I have a very rich environment in which to work. There's a lot of travel involved, maybe 80% of the time.
Oh, dear.
Well, so I can earn a lot of freaking flyer miles.
You and Sigrid can take advantage of it, go somewhere
right.
Nice. I am a fan of Google, but I think there are a lot of people, especially people who just kind of hear on the periphery, oh, Google is spying on us, who are afraid of Google. And it is, after all, a commercial entity. And commercial entities are often threatening to the internet.
Well, that's interesting.
I don't know what the question. I don't know what the question here is, except that you. It's clear you feel comfortable with Google's role.
So let me make two observations about this. First of all, the enterprises, commercial enterprises, are actually very important to the internet. We wouldn't have it if there were not people making money out of the internet. I mean, this had to be a self-sustaining system. And in fact, that's what drove me to advocate for commercialization of the internet as far back as 1988. I didn't think that the general public would have access to the net if it did not have an economic engine running it, built under it. Google has a particularly successful engine because it has managed to build a three-way system for paying for the use of its products and services. It's an advertising company for all practical purposes, and the advertisers pay for the opportunity to show their products and services to users who make use of Google's products and services largely for free. And so it's a three-way arrangement, and it works very well. I accept that Google has grown very rapidly. I think it's had reported well over $50 billion a year run rate now in the recent past from zero 15 years ago. And it has done so well in this space that some people feel threatened by that. I would also argue that Google has taken advantage of the economics of online environments very effectively. And here you have a fundamental challenge for any company that built a business model around the older technologies, including paper. And we all understand, I think, that the news business is under threat because its original business model isn't working anymore. It used to be a powerful advertising engine, but online services have basically removed the revenue from classified ads and from display ads. Although I think if you look at history, you'll discover that the readership of newspapers, which generated some of the revenue from subscriptions, has been declining for the last 20 years or more.
It's not just Craigslist that is killing newspapers.
So I think what you find is that Google is successfully operating in spaces where some other companies who are in a related space or in a similar space but had grown up in a different technological mm-hmm. world, they feel threatened by that. But they really should be worried about the business model that they're using and how that should adapt to the new world of digital technology.
I think that's absolutely true. All right. People are worried about privacy, too, I guess. And I think as Google gets bigger and bigger, there's a concern that Google is doing something with the information it is gleaning from our use of the internet. Nefarious.
Well, it is. Oh, something nefarious.
There's the key word, isn't it? We know it's right. Using it.
So this is very interesting. There are some people who become quite upset with the idea that somehow Google's software is looking at their email.
Yes.
Now, you know, you understand that in order to build email, you have to have a program, and the program has to look at every byte in the message in order to format it properly and put it on the screen. Now, what they're worried about, of course, is that the software also says, what word is this, and do I have any advertisements that might be associated with this word that's in the message? If you really are disturbed by that, maybe you shouldn't use email, but... Google does not sell any of that information, it's not in its interest, nor does it need to do that. What it does is use the information to figure out which of the large number of ads it has in a big ad bag to pull out and show you. And that's all it does. And I think we recently published more detail on the specifics of this so people can understand what does the software do, why does it do it. Do we sell the information to anybody? No. Do we sell ads? Yes. We put up the ads based on the information we have from your Google search or from your email? Yes. And why do we do that? Because it allows us to pay for the services that you're offering, using. So we don't sell any information to any third party. because it's not in our interest to do so, nor is it in our users' interest for us to do that. And in fact, we go way out of our way to protect that information by encrypting all the traffic between the data centers and encrypting it from our users to our data centers. And now we're encrypting email address in the data centers, all of which is intended to defend the privacy and confidentiality of our users' transactions.
I remember very well when the NSF, the National Science Foundation, which kind of ran the internet and ran the big backbone, finally said, okay, we're going to let commercial traffic on the internet. It was recent. Was it 95, 94?
Well, actually, it was earlier than that. Let me take you back to 1988 when I recognized that we needed a commercial internet service in order to make it available to the ordinary users, the general public.
Yeah.
And so I asked for permission to connect the MCI Mail commercial email service to the internet as an experiment. And I got permission from the Federal Networking Council to do that, and that was made up of the program managers at NSF, DOE, Department of Energy, NASA, and DARPA.
And up to this time, the internet had been used by government and research and educational institutions solely.
That's correct. If you had to have a government contract of some kind in order to be able to use it. So at that point, I got permission to make this connection. And by summer of 1989, we had this linkage up between the commercial MCI mail system and the internet. And as soon as we announced that, the other commercial email service companies like CompuServe and Telemail and OnTime and so on all said, well, we want to have the same privilege, and the Federal Networking Council permitted them to do that. And that same year, three commercial internet companies were started in the United States. PSINet out of New York, which moved its headquarters here to Virginia. The second one was UUNet, which was based here in the D.C. area. And the third one was SurfNet, which was based out in San Diego, run by General Atomics. And all three of them interconnected themselves with something called the Commercial Internet Exchange, or the KICS. And that way they could drop traffic only among themselves if there were any issues about the carriage of commercial traffic on the government-sponsored backbones. But you were quite correct that the next thing that happens is around 1992. The voucher bill gets sponsored and is facilitated in part by Vice President Gore, which made it officially legal to carry commercial traffic on the internet backbone, which allowed the private sector to discover that there was a market for these services. So by 1995, the commercial networking market is so well developed that NSF declares that it's going to shut down the NSFNet backbone and let the universities simply purchase commercial service. And in order to maintain connectivity that had been provided by the NSFNet backbone, they established and underwrote the costs for network access points where networks that had otherwise been connected through the NSFNet would be interconnected through multiple network access points. So NSF deserves an enormous amount of credit. And to your earlier question about the history of internet, that period from 73 to 95 or 93 or so deserves NSF deserves some attention for its role in all of that.
I agree, because what a smooth transition that was, and an effective, elegant transition, and it allowed the incredible growth of the internet, the creative explosion that happened right then.
And what's interesting is that I just picked up a book that was published a couple of years ago on European networking, research networking. And what you get from this is the intensity of uptake of all of the internet and other protocols during this experimental period. So there was a very, very rapid exploration of computer communications during the period from the mid-1970s to the present. And a lot of the academic community deserves credit for having demonstrated the feasibility of these things, not only in the United States, but elsewhere.
NSF does actually have a fairly interesting and, I think, relatively complete special report on their website called The NSF and the Birth of the Internet, that's probably worth pursuing or perusing, I should say, if somebody's interested in getting more detail. And there's quite a bit of video and interviews and so forth.
That's a great reference. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, but it is. But we need you to write the book too. And I need to say goodbye because we've used your time up. But boy, there's so many things I would love to get into. The issue of U.S. versus the rest of the world. The internet seems to have been invented here, and yet you just talked about what was going on around in Europe and around the world.
Just on that one point, Leo, I had visitors in my Stanford laboratory way back in 1974 from Japan, mm-hmm. from France, from Norway. From England. I mean, it was a potpourri of international involvement. And the International Network Working Group, which was formed in late 1972, was quite active for quite a while during this early period of packet switching exploration. Some of the people went off to do OSI. Some of them stuck with us in the TCP/IP. Some went in other directions. But there was a very heavy international engagement on this topic. So people who think that the internet is purely an American invention are oversimplifying.
Yeah. And I think you know better than a lot. And I'd love to talk about that, talk about the issue of haves and have-nots, the very important gulf that we need to bridge to make this accessible everywhere. There's so much to talk about. Well, maybe we'll do another one sometime in the future.
I would look forward to that.
Vince. Yeah. Thank you, Vin. Vin Cerf, what do you say? Chief Internet Evangelist at Google, one of the wise old men and women who created something that we use each and every day and have been such great stewards, and I want to thank you for that as well, of this precious thing, bringing it into life and letting it grow in a way that has become so valuable to all, each and every one of us. Thank you for your time, Mr. Cerf.
Thank you so much, Leo. Appreciate I hope it. To see you again on the net.
Soon. On the net. See you on the net. Bye-bye. We do triangulation every Monday morning, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. I hope you will join us for our guests. We have such wonderful guests. If you can watch live, if you can't, of course, we always have on-demand audio and video, a special audio just for the historians available at twit.tv/TRI and wherever you can get netcasts, including iTunes. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week on Triangulation.